Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 24th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, we're starting off our best of 2020s. Now, they're all from BE, that is before Emma Vigeland. On the show, but
Fraser.
We do that so that Emma has the opportunity to watch some of the best of 2020. Otherwise, you would have already seen it because you would have been there. And of course, on the program today, we have Cornell Professor of American Institutions, Susan Mettler, to discuss her latest book, Four Threats, The Reoccurring Crises of American Democracy, and what we can learn from our history when there was democratic deterioration, as she calls it, essentially when democracy was threatened. And in many respects, you know, there's a perception that this threat has gone away because Donald Trump represented it. I think that would be a mistake.
Certainly. The Republican Party that went along with it remains in power.
Without a doubt.
As of now, holding on to the Senate, although hopefully that changes.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But the I think this point of the threat to democracy is I think it's wrong to see it embodied in one person. It is we have seen both some of the limitations of our institutions to protect against a challenge to democracy, but we've also seen the inclination, like you say, of millions of Americans to throw it out the window, and certainly the majority of elected Republican leaders, maybe not all, but a significant portion of them, even when it was quite clear that Donald Trump had lost the election, to pursue this to see where it led. And so there are a lot of reasons to be concerned in that respect. We don't know what the future can bring. Someone had said, who do you think will follow Barack Obama in the presidency? Donald Trump, you would have been literally laughed out of the room had you attempted to say something like that. So, I mean, this is ongoing. And the other thing that's fascinating about this book is that Mettler tells the story of the Wilmington, North Carolina insurrection story in just at the very end of the 19th century, where there was a massive massacre by white citizens of black citizens. In many respects, this era is one that I've become increasingly interested in. That era of Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction, Reconstruction itself tells us a lot about the America that we have today, tells us a lot about the America that we could have had, and maybe the America that we could have. So it's a fascinating story that I barely knew anything about. And Mettler lays it out for us in the context of these threats to democracy. Now, you mentioned one of the big things that is coming up. And now, of course, we've got, really the big thing that could very well define our politics, at least in the short run, is who's going to control the Senate. This is going to have massive implications when it comes to Joe Biden's ability to seat his cabinet, It's going to have implications in terms of the federal judiciary, perhaps some Supreme Court justices. Who knows? But it's also going to have an impact on Joe Biden's ability, at the very least, to add needed stimulus, particularly cities and states. This is not an ethereal issue. Not only does it involve layoffs with cities and states, but it involves the closure of programs that help millions of people across the country that are really difficult to start back up once they're gone. And so the stakes of who controls the Senate are huge. And we are, what now, 11 days away from this race in Georgia. Kelly Loeffler, incumbent. It's a special election for her because she was appointed senator. This is the closest election since her appointment. And she's running against Raphael Warnock and, of course, David Perdue up for re-election against John Ossoff. These are both runoffs, and the polls are close.
Very close. It's within the margin of error. And usually I would think that that would trend more towards Republicans and give them kind of the benefit of the doubt that they could pull it off, as we've seen in recent history. But who knows? This is a very precarious situation for the Republicans as they try to thread this needle that Trump is claiming that everything's rigged. But yeah, you should still go vote in the Georgia runoffs. So we don't know. And we didn't think Trump was going to win. Biden was going to win Georgia. And the infrastructure set up by activists there, people like Stacey Abrams, made that possible. So it's really a toss up right now.
Yeah, very difficult to say. And the polls, like I said, are really tight, all within the margin of error. And one of the things that Raphael Warnock in particular, because people perceive that his chances to be a little bit bigger than Ossoff, although there's really no data to show this, but certainly in the first round, he did better than Ossoff did relative to the other.
And my view is he's a better candidate.
And he could very well be a better candidate and more situated. He is a minister. And he started off his campaign for the runoff in particular and saying, like, Kelly Loeffler is about to unload the kitchen sink on me in terms of attacks, ads. And this is a fascinating one that I was just really surprised about. This is, they used a sermon he gave back in December of 2017. This is when the Republicans were passing a version of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And one of the things that it also did was desperate at the time, and they were not dealing with, was the refunding of the SCHIP program, which is essentially child health care in the states. And this desperately needed to be refunded funded again, I should say, at that time. And yet they were basically cutting taxes for millionaires. The Republicans are using this in some type of retroactive. And remember, like, all the polling showed that that most people did not want these tax cuts, that they didn't feel the implications of these tax cuts.
No, but it was Trump, and Republicans controlled both chambers, and this was their priority.
This was their priority. So here he is criticizing it, and they're attacking him for criticizing the tax cuts. I think the more people in Georgia who see the speech, the better for Raphael Warnock, it seems to me.
I agree.
You folks decide as to why, what they're really trying to do here. And just keep in the back of your minds, like, turn off the sound. As far as they're concerned, like, Reverend Wright, remember? Like, the old Obama attacks on Obama. But who knows what it could be. But here it is.
While others were sleeping, members of the United States Senate declared war and launched a vicious and evil attack on the most vulnerable people in America. Herod is on the loose. Herod is a cynical politician who's willing to kill children and kill the children's health program in order to preserve his own wealth and his own power. Hope is in the air, but Herod is on the loose. The hopes and the fears of all the years have met in thee tonight. And so on Friday night, the United States Senate decided by a slim majority to pick the pockets of the poor, the sick, the old, and the yet unborn in order to line the pockets of the ultra rich. Don't tell me about gangsters and thugs on the streets. There are more gangsters and thugs in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol, than there are. A bunch of.
You know, it's funny because both Loeffler and Perdue have been running as outsiders. They are sitting senators running as outsiders.
Trying to do what Trump did.
And much harder to do as an incumbent.
Much harder to do if you have the charisma of Kelly Loeffler.
Indeed. And also, one of the challenges is that they've been telling people that the votes are rigged. And so they're trying to get people out to vote for that. But that is an election that's going to take place in 11 days from today.
Yeah, and it's clear that they're trying to drum up the fact that he's black, he's speaking to what seems to be a predominantly black church, and he's talking about gangsters and thugs and calling senators that. Oh, no, he's completely ignoring the law and disorder, the disorder in the streets that Trump ran on. But it's all racist. That's what it is.
It's hard to imagine that isn't the subtext of that. It has worked for Republicans in the past. Gosh knows. So let's take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to be replaying this interview I did with Susan Mettler on her book, Four Threats, The Reoccurring Crises of American Democracy. Go to that now. I'd like to welcome back to the program a professor of government from Cornell University, co-author of Four Threats, The Recurring Crisis of American Democracy, Susan Mettler. Suzanne Mettler, welcome to the program. You're a co-author, of course, Robert Lieberman, but welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
So, okay. So I guess the obvious question to begin with, and you go through some great historical examples, and some of which I'd like to talk about in terms of different times where we've had these threats, but you outline, obviously, four distinct threats to our democracy. And fundamentally, your argument is that we uniquely have all four going at the current time. But walk us through the four threats.
That's right. Well, there are four threats that scholars who study the rise and decline of democracies around the world know about, that these are things that make democracy more fragile. And so they are political polarization, which, you know, we certainly have today. It's been rising, particularly since the 1980s in the United States. Conflict over who belongs as a member of the political community. This is typically a conflict over race or gender. In the United States, we find that conflict over the status of African Americans has been a perennial and recurring threat. The third is high and rising economic inequality, which has been on the rise in the United States since the 1970s. And the fourth is executive aggrandizement. And what this refers to is the concentration of power in the top leader. So in the United States, after, you know, traditionally having a system that was more Congress-centered, the president has gained more power right from the 1930s onward. And both parties have contributed to that. But today, for the first time ever, we have all four of these threats in combination. They've each had their own history in the United States of waxing and waning over time and combining in different ways. When even one of them was present, it could create a lot of havoc for the political system. When three were present, which occurred in the 1850s, it led to the Civil War. In the 1890s, it led to the disenfranchisement of millions of African-American men. And then that lasted for, you know, 60 years. Today, for the first time ever, we have all four threats raging at once. So we're in a really precarious situation. American democracy has been fragile at many times in the past. I think we've had the luxury of forgetting about that But now it's fragile again.
All right. So I want to circle back to these four and also sort of how they manifest itself and also, you know, when we've seen the various combinations throughout history. But let's turn for a moment to, I guess, just the other part of your title. Makes it easy. I just work at that level. What do we mean when we say American democracy, right? I mean, what are we really talking about? I know you write it's on a continuum, and it feels like at it's on a continuum, but it's also on sometimes maybe a bit of like a hamster wheel. And sometimes it goes, it waxes and wanes as well. Or maybe that is when we are, so tell us what we mean when we say a democracy, particularly in the context of America.
Yeah, I like that question. It's nicely put. So, some people might assume that the United States has been democratic from the beginning. And, with my students, we study the Constitution, and there are certainly ways in which the United States scaled up the whole notion of democracy for the world and introduced the ideas of representative government on a large scale and freedom of religion, and so on. But of course, there were ways in which the founding was really undemocratic, anti-democratic, with slavery being incorporated into the Constitution, the most obvious of those. And so in the United States, it's fair to say that democracy has developed over time. And I would say that it was really the 1960s that we became a fully democratic nation where civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights were extended to all Americans, regardless of race and gender and so on. And so that was a long story about this arc of democratization. But what we're looking at in the book is periods of time where people were worried that whatever level of democracy had developed up till that point in time was under threat of deteriorating, of backsliding, that we could go back in the other direction of having less democracy. And it's really striking to me the number of times this has happened in the United States and when people had real anxiety that there was going to be backsliding. So that's our concern is, we were motivated to write the book by asking, is the United States in danger today of democratic deterioration? And the idea is not that there'll be tanks in the streets and, a military coup d'etat. Scholars who study democratic deterioration find that while that kind of thing was common up through the middle of the 20th century, what's been more typical since then is backsliding, where you get some features of democracy that stay in place, like you might still have elections, and yet other aspects like the rule of law and the integrity of rights might be undermined, might become weaker.
This may be a sort of a little bit off topic, but tangentially speaking, I mean, where does economic rights fall in that spectrum? Because you mentioned that, in the 60s, we had sort of reached a peak, theoretically, in terms of democracy within this continuum. Could we argue that does that include some form of economic rights? I mean, have we become less democratic in the context of economics or are we backsliding? Like, for instance, when you disempower unions, I mean, like, definitionally, it seems to me that you have less union concentration. That is definitionally, it seems to me, less democratic. Correct? And because the economy, obviously, and economic rights must be a factor within sort of assessing where we are on the continuum of democracy.
Yeah. Well, I agree that in a full and robust definition of democracy, it would include social rights and economic rights. In this book, we take more of a narrow, more strict definition of rights as being civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights. But the kinds of dynamics you're mentioning are really important as a threat to democracy because, you know, this feature of rising economic inequality. Now, you know, when I first heard that that can be a threat to democracy, I thought that that must mean, well, the 99% rises up and you have instability. But that's not, in fact, what it means. It's actually the opposite. Scholars find that around the world and through history, when there's high and rising economic inequality, it's the most affluent, the rich and powerful industries and businesses that then they decide to try to cement their power, to lock down what they have. And they don't care if they trample democracy in the process. And so I think, you know, we've been seeing that going on already over the last couple of decades. As economic elites with their political accomplices have scaled back the power of organized labor, as you've mentioned, of workers generally. And, you know, we're in a really bad time these days for working Americans because of their rights being scaled back. And I think that's why that's come about.
Okay. And again, forgive me for sort of, you know, harping on this, because the narrow definition is in some ways relative to the, I guess, to America in and of itself and aspirationally. Right. But I mean, it seems like there is an argument to be made that a broader definition of democracy would necessarily include not just the ability to vote or the civil rights, you know, the ability to marry who you want, and but also it would involve certain economic rights that would constitute other freedoms, right? That are also inherent to democracy. Like the same ills that can destabilize a society or at least chip away at those other those other democratic rights seems to me to be almost inherent as a democratic right in and of itself. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And, you know, a lot of my earlier work, and you and I've been happy to speak with you about some of my earlier books. Right. I'm really focused on those kinds of things about, you know, how can the United States become more democratic and so that people have rights to, you know, healthcare and fair working conditions and all of those things. But in the book, when I say we take a more narrow definition, it's because we're looking at things that we thought were settled.
Okay.
Where there's not policy debates that have still been going on around them over the past many decades. And, you know, I would put the economic rights there's been more debate over those. But I thought voting rights were a settled matter. And now we're seeing, you know, a lot of efforts in this election to really scale back on free and fair elections and the integrity of the election.
Well, I mean, in some respect, you know, that the scaling back on voting rights certainly predated Trump, right? I mean, we had the Supreme Court roll back the Voting Rights Act,
right,
despite the fact that a duly elected Senate and a duly, you know, had reauthorized that very bill. I mean, that to me. All right. Well, so let's go and look at these four threats, and then we'll talk about two at different times where they have sort of combined. Because you write about the expanse of presidential power. It starts really in many respects with FDR, and increases. The political polarization seems to wax and wane over different periods. You know, I've interviewed people who said in the 50s, people were complaining that there was no difference, no discernible difference between the parties at all on any type of issues. Rising inequality waxes and wanes. And the question of who belongs, that seems to be a dynamic that exists in terms of like who's asserting their right to belong at different times. Right. I mean,
right.
And can we start with that one? Because I mean, what's happening now is that there is a pushback against sort of, I think, you know, something like Black Lives Matter, at least by, you know, a portion of society, I would suggest broadly the white part of society. But also we're, you know, that is because there's a greater assertion of like of black rights in the country. But of course, we're also seeing simultaneously a diminishment of immigrant rights.
Right. Yes, exactly. So this, you know, conflict over who belongs, this, the scholars who study this in countries worldwide, they say that it can be most problematic and recurring if there is a group that, when the country is founded, is really excluded. And so, of course, in the United States, you know, the classic case of that is African Americans' status. And so, you know, until that's really dealt with, a formative rift, as it's called, can create havoc again and again and again. But the interesting thing, and I think what you're noting, is that that's not always the case. So there are some periods of democratic instability in the country where, in fact, conflict over race was not part of it. And not because problems had been solved, rather because they were being suppressed. So this was the case in the 1790s and again in the 1930s, where both sides in the conflict, both parties, as many things as they might have disagreed about, they did not disagree about race. That was kind of taken off the table. Like, we're not going to upset the racial hierarchy. But then there are other periods when you have political polarization, and one of the things the parties is polarized about is racial inequality and the status of African Americans. And so that's very much the case now. You know, it's kind of striking because it would have seemed to a lot of political scientists, like in the late 20th century and early 21st century, like racism was really declining in the United States. And then the country elected our first black president. And then, you know, after that, here's this resurgence of racism. But in fact, what it is it's not that it's widespread across society. It's very concentrated in one party, in the Republican Party. So what's happened is that the country's become much more diverse over the last several decades, but the Republican Party's been kind of standing still. And its composition does not reflect that greater diversity, whereas the Democratic Party does. So you've got a very white party. And then when you look at people's attitudes, Republicans versus Democrats, there's measures that political scientists use called racial resentment. It's a measure of racism. It's actually like people's agreement about questions that tap into, you know, why does racial inequality persist? And resentment is associated with answers that say, well, it's really the fault of African Americans because they lack a work ethic, they're lazy, et cetera. Whereas an answer that is really promoting of racial inequality would say, well, there are persistent laws or historic legacies of laws that have caused this racial inequality. And so Democrats and Republicans have diverged over the last few decades in how they answer those questions. So Democrats have become much more embracing of greater equality. Republicans have become more racially resentful. And so that sets up a big conflict. And so, you know, part of what's driving polarization is that conflict. And so this, it's really organized along partisan lines these days.
So let's go back and let's go back. So you mentioned the 1790s where we had that that polarization, but we did not have the contention over, you know, who was the in-group. I mean, not a way in at least amongst, I guess, folks like us, we would see in a positive way, but it was not in contention at that point. And you had things, I guess, like the Whiskey Rebellion at that time. And let's move forward. You mentioned the next sort of like big. You know what? Before we get there, well, I guess the 1850s is really the time where you have three of these elements converge. And of course, it leads us. And that is quite obviously the who's the in-group, right? Should we have slaves or not becomes an issue. The other is political polarization. And then the third is rising inequality.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about those. I mean, of course, at this point, we did not have expansive presidential power, or maybe we wouldn't have had a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, you tell me.
Well, I think, you know, if those threats, if those three threats were not present in the way they were, we might not have had a civil war. I mean, what happened was that, you know, the South, coming out of the Constitutional Convention, the South was privileged in politics because of the Three-Fifths Compromise, which effectively gave slaveholders and their states extra power in terms of representation in the country. So they were able to, you know, say that they were on board with the project of democracy, going along with representation and elections. But this was democracy on white man's terms, and really on Southerners' terms. But as time went on, they began to lose some of that political power because the country is becoming more and more competitive, and there was abolitionists were succeeding in getting, you know, more and more supporters who were anti-slavery. And so then the South begins to lose power, and they realize if we keep playing this game of democracy, we're going to lose slavery. And they made a choice at that point, which was it going to be slavery or going by these rules of the game? And they chose slavery. So at that point, you know,
what would have gone by the rules of the game meant in terms of like being subjected to what the North wanted to do?
Starting to lose in elections. And in the book, we tell the whole story of what was happening in Kansas. You know, it was a territory. And so it had to decide whether it was going to be slave or free. And you had the two different sides in Kansas. They just couldn't even agree on how to run elections in order to make these decisions for the territory. And so they would have their own elections and not respect each other's, et cetera. And then that became a microcosm of what began to happen in national politics as well. So, and you know, then ultimately Lincoln is elected and the South secedes because it just, you know, can't go along with that at all. And so it says, we're out of here. And that's what happens with polarization. It's why polarization ultimately is a threat to democracy. If one side decides we want to win on our priorities at all costs, and we don't care if we run roughshod over democracy in the process.
I mean, as you talk about that advantage that the South had in terms of the Three-Fifths Compromise, right, where they were able to get basically extra voting power relative to who they had to distribute resources to, which is essentially, I guess, what that comes down to, sort of feels a little bit reminiscent of what our Senate composition is right now, and that we've had two Republican presidents who have won their first elections in a row with less votes than the person who lost the election. And you start to wonder, and of course, we see this dynamic, let's say, in Wisconsin, and we see it in Pennsylvania on some level, although Pennsylvania, I guess, has sort of fixed itself in some respects. But this idea of the minority of people, of voters, have elected what the majority of lawmakers. And at one point, those of us who are voting for people and saying, hey, wait a second, this is supposed to work like where if you get more votes, and it, you know, it's one thing to have it happen in the presidential election. We have a quirky system. I mean, it's another to have it exclusively in the Senate where it's like, okay, 40% of the country is determining what the other 60%, you know, what the values and the structure is for 60%. And you start to see this in states. Like at one point, the people who are saying that, wait, I'm getting 3/5 of a vote here, essentially, or 4/5 of a vote, we're going to change the system if we get in position of power. The other side is going to feel that loss pretty, I mean, so, you know, We could be talking about court packing. We could be talking about, Washington, D.C. is going to be made into a state, I think. Puerto Rico is a sort of a separate set of issues. But there may be, genuine reforms that begins to put this back in balance. And that is the problem, that the side that had been enjoying this advantage, they then are faced with that loss. I mean, that seems to be like the story of everything that's going on now, is that people who have had an advantage perceive their loss of an advantage as oppressive in some way.
Yeah, no, I think there is a lot to that. And there are a lot of political scientists who study political behavior, and they're finding this, that resentment is a real underlying theme in politics that we're seeing these days, and that has been driving the Republican Party in many ways. But, today's Republican Party is becoming a party that does not want to play by the rules, and that does not want to, abide by these, what I call the pillars of democracy: free and fair elections, rule of law, legitimacy of the opposition, and integrity of rights. But rather wants to win at all costs, be able to, stack the courts at all costs, be able to pursue its policy priorities at all costs, even if these pillars of democracy are violated in the process. And, we see this, as you noted earlier, these trends well predate Trump. They've been emerging for some time, for many years. And we see Trump as, more of an outcome of that process. And we think it will continue long after he's gone from public office, whenever that is. So I think, our political system, because of the kinds of things you're mentioning, we're in for a long period of careening. And so it's really important for people to get straight in their heads what it is that's our priority. And I think that we need to be thinking about these basic principles of democracy and embracing them. I think for a long time we were able to take them for granted, and we can't now. And, it's easy for people to get very focused on their policy priorities, but I think unless we really come together to protect democracy, that it's a losing battle, because ultimately, who's in charge if you don't have democracy? It's really just the most affluent people, the most organized interests, the most powerful industries, and everyone else is really out of the picture.
I want to come back to that, because those are basically the settled issues that you were talking about, those principles that create the structure where theoretically you have a better opportunity to have policies that are reflected in the desires of people, right? I mean, that's the idea, is that you create the bucket, and then, we all have different ideas of what the water is, but the people will decide what it is as long as the bucket is holding water. But I want to go back in history just a little bit, because I did not know anything about that Wilmington, North Carolina situation in the late 1890s. Right. And it's fascinating. I mean, this era, I say this almost every day now, but this era, this Reconstruction and sort of post-Reconstruction era is just like a massive blind spot in our national consciousness. And the more you see, hear about it, the more you sort of understand it as to why it is a blind spot. It's almost like this sort of like these traumas that the country has been forgetting, but have been gnawing away at us. Tell us about that, what happened in Wilmington, because this is, it really is stunning.
It is stunning. And, everything you just said is so well put. While I was working on this chapter for many months, it was eye-opening to me and deeply, deeply disturbing. So in the late 19th century, I think a lot of Americans know that we had Reconstruction, and then it formally speaking comes to an end. But what people don't know is that in the decades after that, in the late 19th century, that African Americans in the South continued to vote in many states at pretty high levels, and to run for office at all levels. There were members of Congress, but there were a lot of people in local office in particular. And so democracy there and elsewhere in the country seemed to be pretty healthy. You had very competitive and robust political parties, and you had people participating in politics at high rates, men who had elected, who had voting rights at that point in time, of course. Then you get to the 1890s, and Southern Democrats, which was the party run by white elites, business people in the South, they were really getting tired of having to compete in every election. And it was becoming harder for them because African-Americans who tended to be Republicans found that if they could ally forces with the new populists who were emerging, who were tended to be lower middle income white people, that they could actually win elections. They would work together and create what they called a fusion ballot and, you know, run candidates from both of their parties together, and they could beat the Democrats. And this happened in North Carolina during the 1890s. So at some point, the Democrats there said, okay, we've had enough. We're going to pull out the stops. We've been trying everything. We've been stuffing ballot boxes. We've been using the threat of violence. It's not enough. And what they did is they had they staged a coup d'etat in the city of Wilmington on November 10th, 1898. This was a city where African-Americans had been really moving into the middle class and were being elected, were serving on the city council and in all sorts of positions. And that all came crashing down in one day.
And excuse me, if I remember correctly, too, you wrote there was one position that was appointed where you had and it was appointed, a black man was appointed, and he would be the highest paid individual in the city government of anybody. And that created a tremendous amount of resentment.
You know, we're going back to the resentment theme again here. I think there was a lot of resentment. When I look at all these documents from that period, you can really see it writ large. And so, but on the morning of November 10th, there were thousands of people, white men in paramilitary groups that had, some of them were really organized by the Democratic Party, and they gathered at the city armory, and then they marched to the offices of this black-owned newspaper, and they burned it down. And then from there, they marched into black neighborhoods, and as the day wore on, they killed hundreds of people, and they took others. They took various city leaders and, you know, high-ranking people to the train station and made them leave town. And at the end of the day, they actually at gunpoint made those who were the city officials resign their positions, and then they installed their own handpicked folks in their place. Within a few weeks after that, they managed to now change in the state the requirements for voting and to introduce literacy tests and poll taxes. And this same thing, like we really, in the book, we highlight North Carolina because there with this coup d'etat, things came out into the open that were happening more quietly in states all over the South. All over the South, they managed to have constitutional conventions and to change the constitutions to have these poll taxes and literacy tests, disenfranchising African-Americans. And once people lost their voting rights, once they lost political power, then in turn, they lost civil liberties and civil rights. You had Jim Crow was set up. And, you know, what we tend to, I think of this as, well, that just happened in one region, that happened in the South. But it was sanctioned by national leaders in the Republican Party, by President McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt and Taft, who all, you know, looked the other way and condoned it while all of this was happening. And it also meant that white supremacists in the South then had extra leverage, again, the way they had under the Three-Fifths Clause, had extra leverage again in national politics and shaped our national politics for the next 60 years. So it's a really consequential story.
And in terms of the implications for now, what struck me was you had this very, very concentrated brief window of violence, and then everything in it almost like, you know, even in the context of doing the show, like when there's growth with this show, it's a spike, it drops back down, but it achieves a new normal. Mm-hmm. if you look at that sort of concentrated moment of violence, and literally we're talking like a week, and enough happened in that moment where they were able to sort of change, then immediately institutionalize this new normal into changes in voting laws and the way that that then had a durability that lasted decades. I mean, it sort of feels like we're going along here, and it's quite possible that the next 3 months of this country's future will determine decades of where we go after that. And that, to me, that's what that Wilmington thing, I mean, in addition to, like, this is a moment in history I had no idea about. And there's multiple stories over the years that I have, like, heard of this, particularly around race, where, you know, obviously in Tulsa, but also the Northwest Territories, where you had just assaults on Black people who had basically, you know, succeeded in the way that we talk about this, or were in the process of success in attaining, and boom, within a very short window of time, there's like a violent turn, a spike of extra lawful activity, if you will. And then it just gets institutionalized because those things are fixed. And, you know, we're looking at like a 6-3 Supreme Court. That's one of those things. Or we're looking at a, you know, I mean, these are, that's what I find really disturbing about it. I mean, I think that's why he wrote the book.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I so appreciate you laying all of that out, because that's exactly what my co-author and I were seeing as we laid out this story. And it's why watching this year of 2020 evolve, you know, since the book went off to press, and, you know, we were already seeing some eroding around the pillars of democracy, but in the months since it went off to press, things have become much worse. And we think we're at a really dangerous and troubling time.
And we should say, we're talking on a day where there's a report, at least by The Nation magazine, that you had DHS people, you know, cloning people's phones in Portland to, you know, and there's some speculation that the arrests of these unmarked federal policemen were arresting people off the streets because they thought they knew what they were going to do in the future because of having their phone information. I mean, so, okay. So with all that said, what do we do about that? If we went back to Wilmington, you know, in I guess October, and we had the ability to warn everybody there, what would we have said?
Golly, you know, it's a big question. I mean, I think it's the right way to phrase the question, because often people say to me, well, how can we rein in these four threats? And, you know, reining in the four threats, that's really hard. And that may take years or decades to rein in political polarization, for example. And really the question is more urgent. It's the way you just phrased it. It's, you know, what would you have told the folks in Wilmington a month ahead of time? I mean, the folks in Wilmington probably should have, you know, if we could have warned them with the hindsight of history, we would have told them to get out of town for the time being. But I think that Americans really need to know what is at stake right now. I think there's such, you know, the past few years, the news every day is overwhelming, and it's hard to sort it all out. And it's hard to sort out which stories are just kind of, you know, about unsavory tweets that are kind of offensive, versus which stories are about policy changes that actually matter, versus these fundamental changes to the pillars of democracy that can erode the system and stack the deck for some time to come. And so we're trying to shine a bright light on the latter and how important it is to to preserve those things. I mean, fortunately, at this moment, Americans can still choose. There's nothing deterministic about these threats that shape the outcome of history. And right now we have an election coming up that if people actually take part in it at large numbers, they can have their voices heard. I mean, I do think there's a lot of there are a lot of efforts to be tipping the scales in the election, but I think that overwhelming participation can make those things less important.
Yeah, I mean, it occurs to me that, you know, if we were to take that time travel thing and land in October in Wilmington, 1898, you know, it would be just expand your imagination a little bit of how bad this can get, you know, in the short term. And obviously you at that point, you're only 30 years out from slavery. So, you know, the idea of like a massacre, wouldn't be that you wouldn't have to expand your imagination too much. I mean, I think it's quite easy 30 years out. If there is a vibrant middle class and you have, black politicians and you have black leaders of the community and a majority of black people living in that area, it might be harder than I think we can imagine now, right? 30 years goes like this when you look back on history, but in the context of actually living it, feels like a lifetime ago, maybe for some of these people on some level. We don't have that. I think violence is really not so much the issue, but I look at things like, you know, Azar taking over the FDA, and we know why they're doing that. It is because they want the ability to sort of say, like, the vaccine is here, or something to that effect. And we see this in agency after agency. We see the DOJ today say, we're not coming to your congressional hearings because last time you were there, you were very petulant and you didn't ask me the right questions. So you don't get a second bite at this apple. You know, you suspend the sort of like concern about that because you think, well, the election will happen. But, you know, regardless of how many people come out to vote, there's still an opportunity that, that Donald Trump may end up being president. And then all of these things that we're talking about as anomalies become institutionalized for the next at least 4 years. And gosh knows what the opportunity is going to be 4 years from now. We have already seen the fecklessness of Congress at this point to deal with this. There's no reason to think that they're going to be particularly more adept at this if they have another bite at the apple. It's incredibly concerning. And I guess I appreciate your coming to talk to us about it. I don't think I'm going to sleep very much again tonight. The book is The Four Threats, The Recurring Crisis of American Democracy. Susan Mettler, we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I've really appreciated the conversation.
So there it is. We'll put a link to Four Threats of the Reoccurring Crises of American Democracy at majority.fm. Emma, so it is Christmas Eve day.
Yeah.
Obviously, Christmas celebrations are not necessarily for most people, a lot of people. I don't know. Like the traditional one, because we're living in a pandemic. What do you do for Christmas generally?
Generally? Well, my mom is, I have it at my mom's place. My mom is just like the entertainer of the family. She loves having everybody over. So this has been especially heartbreaking for her. Thanksgiving, I mean, we had to have a conversation where I was like, no, you can't invite the other members. And she knows this, but she goes, well, maybe I should ask them first. I go, no, because they're going to try to weasel their way in. You got to say, no, you can't come. And so I think she's going to be pretty sad, but I got her some nice gifts. I'll try to cheer her up.
Oh, well, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Now, what I do is I don't celebrate Christmas because I celebrate Hanukkah.
Right.
And it's not. I don't do that. So basically, for me, Christmas is my kids are with their mom celebrating Christmas. I get to stay at home. And what I usually do is just like clean the house.
Oh, that's very festive. I mean, nesting, they say, is great way to cure anxiety, even though I don't do it enough. I still have boxes in my apartment that I've just not unpacked for no reason.
Yeah, so there it is. But folks, have a wonderful
Merry Christmas. Merry. That's how you say it.
Oh, Merry Christmas?
Yeah, have you heard that?
I engaged in the war on Christmas for so long that it doesn't come naturally. But folks, have a Merry Christmas. Stay safe. I imagine people already have their plans, but stay safe. Next couple of weeks are going to be difficult for the pandemic, but we will get to the other side of this. We will be back all next week with Best of Shows 2020. Enjoy them. Let us hope that this is the beginning of a better year. I think 2021, It would be tough to be worse than 2020. But Emma, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. And I mean, whatever.
All right, folks. We'll check you out tomorrow. Oh, there it is.
Right on time.
There you go.
All right, great.
Cool.
All
right,
guys. Thank you. Cool. Thank you, guys. Sorry about that. We'll see you tomorrow.
Good to see you.
All right.
Bye.